All right. Well, thank you all for joining us today. I am Amy Margolis. I'm a division director in the Office of Adolescent Health at HHS and the lead for our teen pregnancy prevention program. And I want to acknowledge my colleague Amy Farb is our evaluation specialist, and she couldn't be here today, but she was essential in this work. And in the back of the room is Alexandra Warner, who this presentation wouldn't be possible without her. She's an evaluation fellow in the office. So thank you, Alexandra. I have no relationships to disclose. I wanted to start with a little bit of an overview of the OAH Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program. I'm going to be talking today about the implications and importance of program evaluation using some of the findings from our program, but I wanted to give a little bit of the background just to kind of set the context. Our program is one of six different evidence-based initiatives at the federal government right now, and we're using Tier 1 and Tier 2. It's different than the previous presenters, Tier 1 and Tier 2. We receive approximately $100 million a year and fund five-year grants. Our funding comes as a two-tiered evidence initiative, so 75% of our funding is for the replication of evidence-based programs, and 25% of our funding is to support research and demonstration around new and innovative approaches to prevent teen pregnancy. We have some additional funding for program support. We do a lot of training and technical assistance. We review all materials to ensure that they're medically accurate. And then we've been really lucky that we've received some additional funding dedicated for evaluation of teen pregnancy prevention, and that has allowed us to support all of our performance measure data collection, the evaluation training and technical assistance that we do, and then several different federal-led evaluation studies that I'll talk about. So most of our funding, like I said, is dedicated to the replication of evidence-based programs. Our program and our office are only 5 years old, and so as we were getting started, we knew if we were going to be funding replication of evidence-based programs, we had to define what evidence-based programs were. That had never been done before by the federal government. So our office, in collaboration with the Administration for Children and Families and the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation, support the HHS Pregnancy Prevention Evidence Review. It is a systematic review of the teen pregnancy prevention literature. Through the evidence review, we sort of set the bar for what constitutes rigorous, high-quality evaluation, and the studies that are reviewed have to meet that bar for a quality study on rigor, and then if they meet that bar, if they have a positive finding on either teen pregnancy or births, STIs, or associated sexual risk behaviors, and that's anything from sexual initiation, condom use, contraceptive use, number of partners, then those programs are added to the evidence review, the evidence list. The review was originally done in 2010. It's updated about every year, year and a half, and we currently have 37 very diverse evidence-based programs identified on the evidence list. Our grantees, so we just finished funding for our first cohort of grantees. They just ended August 31st, 2015. We had funded 75 grantees to replicate evidence-based programs in 39 states and D.C. Those grantees did amazing things and served over 500,000 youth over the last 5 years. Their grants were large, which I think is important. They were very well resourced to do the work that they did and the evaluations that they did. And 16 of our largest grantees in the Tier 1 category were funded to conduct a rigorous evaluation. In Tier 2, which is our research and demonstration group, we funded 27 grantees. 18 of them were funded to rigorously evaluate new and innovative approaches. It was a partnership between us and CDC, were funded to develop and test a community-wide approach to teen pregnancy prevention, and then one is doing something a little different where they're supporting a community collaborative academy to help communities kind of plan and implement their plan for teen pregnancy. We had a sort of set of expectations. This was just a really high-level overview. We expected all of our grantees to engage in a phased implementation period. We thought it was really important to take the first year, at least the first year, to kind of really make sure you assess the needs, to pilot the programs you were planning to do, to get all your staff trained, to make sure when you implemented to scale, you were ready to go. And I think that was a big lesson learned. It was very important to allow that time to happen. Grantees were expected to maintain fidelity to their program model. And for us, when we say we replicated evidence-based programs, we maintained fidelity to the content and how the program was implemented. We did not replicate sort of in the same settings and the same populations that the original programs were done. And for our evaluation findings, that's important because we are able now to say something about kind of taking evidence-based programs into different populations and different settings. We expected high levels of quality to keep the youth engaged and retained through the program. We require grantees to make sure the programs are medically accurate and age appropriate. And then we have a lot of expectations around collection of performance measure data and using data to make decisions, really high evaluation expectations. Like I said, we've funded a bunch of evaluation, and one of the things that we decided really early on is if we have this evidence review and we have set sort of a standard for what constitutes high quality evaluation through the evidence review, all of the evaluation work that we fund through our grants will meet that bar. So that's kind of what we had our eye on the whole time. And then for our Tier 2 grants, we required them to package their materials to be implementation ready so that if at the end of 5 years they're found to be effective, they're ready for someone else to implement them. So our evaluation strategy, we think that we're unique in the federal government. We may be unique in other settings, that we have invested so much and put so much emphasis on rigorous evaluation. Our evaluation strategy, we've funded over 40 different independent evaluations across our Tier 1 and Tier 2. You can see in Tier 1, we have independently evaluated 10 of the different evidence-based programs, and for several of them, there's more than one evaluation of each, which is important because we can now say, you know, we have some more evidence behind each of the programs about kind of do they work in different settings and different populations, implemented in different ways. While we have the evidence review and we have 37 different programs on them, most of those programs have a single study behind them, which is a pretty, you know, it's not a deep bench to sort of have the evidence for our program. So it doesn't say a whole lot about kind of do they work, you know, in all the different places we want to implement them. And then the other thing to point out here, we have a mix of sort of federal evaluations that were run out of our office and then independent grantee level evaluations that were run and implemented by the grantees. For all of our evaluations, we collected a standard set of performance measures across them, and we provided a lot of evaluation training and technical support so that they would kind of maintain that high-level quality bar that we were looking for. We get the question a lot about why do so much evaluation. We've been criticized several times for it. Because we're implementing evidence-based programs, so why would you continue to evaluate evidence-based programs? And I think there's been a lot of publication recently that supports our message. Our response has been the same, but between the publications that have come out recently and then our evaluation results, I think it supports why to keep doing evaluation. The truth is, for the teen pregnancy prevention field, the evidence base is pretty young. So like I said, for most of the evidence-based programs, we have a lot of them, there's a single study backing them up. So it's not a deep bench for those programs. And there have been a couple of things that we thought we'd pull out and quote here, but John Barron has said from the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy, has said, to have strong confidence in a program's effectiveness, one would generally look for replication of positive RCT findings across different real-world implementation sites. And so, you know, that's some of what we've done through our evaluation work, and I think it supports kind of the need to keep doing that. And then it's a little disheartening, but in several different fields, I think cancer, I can't remember where else, there have been commentaries about sort of less rigorous evidence, while valuable for identifying promising programs, too often is reversed in subsequent more definitive research. And the estimates have been as high as 50 to 80%. So from the original replication study, when you go out and try to replicate it, 50 to 80% of those replications do not show the same effects. So the importance to keep building evidence for our programs and to kind of have more than one study behind them so we really know and can be confident in their results. This is just a slide. We alluded to the amount of evaluation support that we provided. We really did provide a lot of support. We found it was essential to keep the rigor of the evaluations. Evaluation is really hard in the real-world setting, and you know, usually people are just out there doing it by themselves. So we had sort of a whole team to support our grantees and their evaluators. So as they hit challenges, we were constantly kind of brainstorming together and helping them, and we were talking a lot. And I think it was really important. This is just also a quick picture of our evaluation designs. The main point here is just to say most of our evaluations were a randomized control trial, either at the individual level or the cluster level. You can see kind of the mix of sort of the age of the kids between high school, middle school, and then the settings were pretty diverse. And then the other important point is about our control. That bar chart just kind of gives you a little sense of where the what the control youth received. For the most part, it was business as usual, but the great thing about teen pregnancy prevention now is there's lots of resources to support teen pregnancy prevention, so there's a lot more going on than there had been in the past. So for our evaluations, it's important to know kind of what did the control youth receive. In some cases, it was nothing or almost nothing, and then in other cases, it was something similar to the teen pregnancy prevention program that has implications for what we can say. For data collection, I said all of our grantees collected the same performance measure data. So they all collected data at baseline and then both a short-term and a long-term follow-up. And the behaviors and intentions listed, we have data on those from all of our evaluations. So each evaluation also could add, you know, other questions specific to their program. But it's really important, I think, that we have this sort of standard data across them all. It kind of gives us opportunities for meta-analysis and things like that later, which we're hoping to do. And then for our results, they're preliminary still, so we're still sort of going through the process of finalizing everything, but what it does look like is our results are falling into kind of three buckets. So the first one, the green bucket, is where the implementation and the evaluation was really strong, and the evaluator found the same or different positive impacts of the program, and that was about 21%. The yellow bucket is where the implementation, the evaluation was strong, but we didn't see the same positive findings. And then the third bucket is, you know, there were challenges. There were either challenges with the implementation or the evaluation, and so we really can't draw conclusions from those evaluations. And that third bucket for our replication of evidence-based programs was a combination of sort of the kids not getting the program, so it was really hard to get them to keep showing up, and the retention rates were really low, and so, you know, to say kind of anything about that program, the kids didn't really get it, so we kind of put them in that bucket. Or it was the issue about contrast, where when you look at what the youth in the control group got, they got something pretty similar to sort of what the evidence-based program was, and so you really can't kind of draw distinctions. So that's mainly what's in that bucket. The other two, you know, I think I said earlier the 50 to 80%, this is what we expected. So we were really happy. I think the other way to look at this is we tested 10 different evidence-based programs, and of the 10, we were able to replicate findings for 4. That's tier one. In tier two, these are new and innovative programs, so it's an important caveat. We didn't expect all these to work. This is kind of where we take risk, right? So even if you don't find positive findings, you learn something really important, you kind of build on it, and you do something moving forward based on what you found. But using the same three buckets, 32% of our tier two evaluations, you know, implemented well, evaluated well, and had positive behavioral outcomes. 42% fell in that bucket where they were implemented and evaluated well, but did not find positive behavioral outcomes. And then about 26% of them were inconclusive. In tier two, the inconclusive bucket is a little different. Most of these were evaluations done with especially vulnerable youth. And the main challenge was they couldn't get enough kids for the sample size. So the sample sizes ended up being too low. So a really important lesson learned from this is I think we feel like we need different strategies for evaluating programs with especially vulnerable youth. We're sort of thinking about, you know, multiple implementers, you know, doing the same thing where you can pool their data, because it just seems really hard to get enough kids. And then what we're doing is we're building our evidence base sort of with the general population and hoping that those programs will work with our most vulnerable youth, but we really don't know if they do. So I think there's a really important lesson learned in that bucket. The other way to look at these findings, we think, it's still preliminary, but we think we're adding 8 new programs to the evidence list, which is really exciting. A lot of the programs on the evidence list are pretty old, if anybody's familiar with them, so this is kind of 8 new programs, so it's a big deal for the field. We had impacts all over the place, so this is just a slide kind of across all of our evaluations with impacts, where they fell, kind of behavioral and secondary. The one thing that was really interesting to us, and I think is a big lesson for the field, is, you know, we always kind of assumed that the logic model was kind of knowledge, attitudes, intentions would then lead to behavior, and we didn't find that across our evaluations. So we have some where they have behavioral impacts and they don't have impacts on knowledge, attitudes, or intentions, and then reverse. We have some where they had impacts on knowledge, attitudes, and intentions, but not behavioral impacts. So kind of one of our findings and implications is we think that folks need to take another look at the logic model and try to figure out, you know, what really is kind of predictive of behavior, and are our logic models still correct? Very interesting. Overall, our conclusions, we think our findings are consistent with other large evaluation efforts. We think this is a significant contribution to the teen pregnancy prevention field and probably broader than that. Like I said, we were able to identify 8 new evidence-based programs. We found 21% of our replication of evidence-based program evaluations were able to replicate the original findings. 4 of the 10 evidence-based programs we were able to replicate. And then we've identified lots of areas where there's additional research or considerations and lots of implications for the field. And I wanted to spend some time here going through those implications because I think they're pretty critical. So one, we feel like it's really important to have independent replication evaluations. So again, you know, there's for most of these evidence-based programs, there's one evaluation behind them, but most of those programs, that one evaluation was done by the developer. So it's really important that we get some independence into the evaluation of these programs to really see kind of do they hold up. The second is, and I've said this a couple of times, but we really need to build a body of evidence behind these programs so that we know kind of when, where, and how they're effective. That failure to replicate the original results does not mean the original study was wrong. We've gotten that question before from developers. So are you saying my original study was wrong? No. You know, but in some cases, that was done 15 or 20 years ago. It was done in a different setting. It was done with a different population. Times change. You know, maybe not all programs can be implemented anywhere with anyone. That's the next bullet. I think we feel like what we've shown is that not all programs can be implemented everywhere and with everyone and have the same impacts. And I think we hear that a lot in teen pregnancy prevention, especially from program developers. You know, you develop a program, you evaluate it in a certain place, and I think you hope that it will kind of work wherever with whoever. And I think that's not necessarily the case. So there needs to be evaluation to kind of back that up. And then the other thing, programs that were effective at one point in time may really no longer be effective at a later point in time. And it's really important to continue to engage the target population and ensure that programs still are resonating with them and engaging them, because a lot of the evaluation research, by the time it takes to even publish it, you know, the publication is 20 years old, but it's really 25 years old or 23. You know, that things change, especially with kids, but probably with all of us in 20 years. That's a big period of time. The other thing is that how programs are implemented impacts who receives the program and the outcomes of the program. So another thing we hear a lot is, you know, you can implement it over 1 day, you can implement it over 2 days, you can implement it over 4 weeks or 8 weeks, it's all the same. And I think what our grantees have shown is, yes, you can implement it in all those different ways, but how you implement changes who shows up, right? There's certain kids who can show up for a full Saturday for 9 hours. There's other kids who can stay with you for 8 weeks. And so really, it's not all the same. And you need to think about kind of how your implementation strategy will impact who's in the room and what the results of that program are. We also think fidelity and adaptations must be monitored and measured. We've paid a lot of attention to that. It's really easy to sort of lose track of what fidelity means and to make adaptations that change core components. And then training, technical assistance, and performance measures are essential. They're essential to ensuring rigorous evaluation. They're also really essential to ensuring high-quality programs. And then the last thing I said earlier, I think we need to re-examine the existing logic models and intermediary measures and figure out kind of what's going on, because something's going on. I'm not a researcher, so I don't know exactly what's going on, but something's going on. It looks a little messy. Other lessons learned for us, and I think this has applicability to other fields as well, we found more time and emphasis needs to be spent on program selection and implementation. We are really spending a lot of time looking, assessing needs, assessing capacity to figure out program fit. It's not enough to just sort of pick a program to implement because you've always done it, or you like it, or you already have the materials, or you've been trained. You really need to think about, is the program you're going to be implementing a good fit for the population you're serving? Also using implementation frameworks to guide planning and keep organized. We're using getting to outcomes, but there's lots of other implementation frameworks, and I think we're building evidence showing that using those frameworks kind of improves quality of programs. Also ensuring participants receive the full dosage. we had a lot of challenges with retention and engagement, especially for the longer programs that last, you know, more than just a couple of weeks. It's really hard to get those kids to come back. And so before you decide to implement one of those programs, you have to think about, do you have strategies in place to get the kids to actually get the full dosage? Because the results and the outcomes of those programs change whether the kids get them or they really don't. And then ensuring staff have comfort, capacity, and skills to implement the programs. We also have some evaluation results to sort of support kind of the idea of teachers kind of being forced to implement the program against their will, not having the same kind of results as, you know, folks who, you know, came to the table willing and engaged. And so there's implications for that. The other big thing, and this is something we're still dealing with, but using evaluation results to inform program selection is really hard. So, you know, in some cases, we need to be willing to move away from programs that are no longer effective. We need to be willing to move away from programs that we already have kind of invested in training and technical assistance and materials. But if we're going to do the evaluation, we feel strongly like we have to use it to then inform our program and to learn from it and continue to grow. And it's not easy. Challenges, I alluded to a lot of these. We need new strategies to evaluate hard-to-reach populations, our most vulnerable youth. The evaluation strategies we're using are not working to build the evidence for them. We need to look at alternative behavioral measures for younger youth. One of the great things is that the rates of sexual activity have declined so much. So a lot of our younger youth are not having sex, which is wonderful, but our evaluations are still geared to sort of only measure sexual activity. So we really need to think about kind of what are the measures before sexual activity that are predictive of sexual activity and be looking at those measures. And we don't know what those are yet, but we feel like we have to start thinking about that. Also, there's a huge need to address reporting and publication bias. We, sort of coming out of the last 5 years, feel pretty strongly like the results probably were always mixed, but the only thing that ever gets published are when you have positive results. And so, you know, we're committed to being transparent and putting all the results out there because we think it's just as important to learn from what didn't work as it is to learn from what did work. And I don't know, I'm going to just say it everywhere I go, so if you guys could also repeat the message, the more we can get people to publish, and I think it's on the journal and on the researcher, when things don't work is just as important. And then I think as funders, we need to incentivize and fund independent replication evaluations. This idea of like, well, why would you evaluate? We need to change that talking point because it's really important. Just a plug for what's coming. So we have committed to transparency. Once the evaluation reports are finalized, they will all be available on our website. We expect that the HHS Pregnancy Prevention Evidence Review will be updated in early 2016. January, February is what they're telling us, and hopefully some of these new programs will get added to the list then. And we are publishing a supplement in AJPH, probably fall 2016, I think is the time frame, that should have at least half of our evaluation studies in it. There's my contact information, and thank you very much.